Voices here at CFRC. If you're listening, Craig, get ready. We have a few questions specifically on this issue of, you know, just what happens when you have a land claim in your area. What's the municipality's legal action to follow? I would say, guess what?
What exactly is a reeve? That would be my question.
Oh, that's the same as a mayor. Well, it's smaller community, townships, municipalities.
Oh, okay.
That sort of thing, a reeve. So a mayor in some corporations.
He's more or less like a semi-big cheese in the community.
Right, but the community votes them in or out.
And he didn't know that this was happening in his neighborhood?
Well, it seems to be what it's like.
Sounds like Boss Hogg.
Mm. Well, but he's done the right thing, though. He's made a request for the staff to find the information and get it back to the council.
All right.
So they'll be informed. Yeah.
Certainly they will be.
Mm-hmm. In November, we invite them in on a phone call.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that'd be fun. Anyway, I guess it's after 7 o'clock. You need to do something.
Oh gosh, is it?
Yeah, it's 7:01.
It's 7:01, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM. We're broadcasting from Queen's University, Crothers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. It's still 7:01.
Yeah.
Okay. We have to do this. I tend to think
all
it was,
the time.
Yeah, like every hour on the hour, we gotta say, mm-hmm. We have to state the obvious.
The time.
Yeah.
The station.
The time. The station.
The program. Aboriginal Voices.
We have to do the whole kit and caboodle.
And since we're live here, we're having too much fun talking.
Well, I don't know if fun was the right word.
Oh, it is fun. Come on. Later this hour.
I mean, I was having fun.
Yes, I know.
Teasing.
Yes.
I would say teasing.
TV teasing.
Television teasing. It just put me in mind.
Yeah.
The actor, mm-hmm. I did not know this until recently, the uh-huh. actor who played Boss Hogg apparently was in one of the wars. I'm going to say the Second World War.
He was in a war?
He was in the war. Like, for real. Like, I'm not screwing around now.
Oh, okay.
I'm telling you truth.
Oh.
He was in a war. And the guy who played there, he knew seven languages.
Wow.
He could speak seven or something like that. Seven languages. And I was like, you would not think that from him portraying Boss Hogg.
Oh, I see. Yeah. He was a good actor.
A great actor.
Yeah, and if he could speak those languages, he could act anywhere.
Yeah, mm. He's not anymore. He's
no, no.
He's passed he could on have. Now, but... Yeah.
All right, something else that we're going to talk... I did an interview with Ralph Boston, who was... he's retired now from teaching at the university level and consulting. I'm not sure if he's actually finished consulting, but anyway. Ralph Boston and I sat down and we did a conversation about a paper he wrote. And the paper is The Mississauga People. And he wrote this in 2024. He published it. And it's the history of the Mississauga people from north. Part one is the north of Kingston. So that's Kingston, Westport, Oso, Collins Bay area, even reaching out towards Seeley's Bay, going north. And it centers around the land now held by Queen's University Biological Station. And, his initial study was to examine the presence of Indigenous people on the land now held by the Queen's Biological Station. That's Lake of Pinacon, Buck Lake, sort of the part of the Rideau Trail goes through that property. I hike up there. That's why I know.
Of course you do.
Yeah. Perth Road area. And it reaches down to Kingston to almost where, right down to where the Cataraqui River goes. And you know, here in Kingston, there's a point, Mississauga.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Just now, it's actually the point where I think the Marine Museum is down that way.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That far?
Yeah. There were the folks who were here and met this guy Champlain when he came with his canoe and his friends from way up north. The here in Wyandotte. They brought him down this way to show him the territory.
Mm-hmm.
1609 or something like that. Yeah.
Back in the day.
Back a few years ago. Anyway, so they actually built a fort, and they called it Fort Frontenac. You know where that is? Do you know where the big...
Was it in Frontenac?
Yeah, it's just over by that big arena. It's now called the Slush Puppy Arena.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Fort Frontenac's right on the edge of that. Actually, it's part of that. I think the arena's built on top of part of the fort. But anyway, so Ralph's going to talk. This is going to be our second conversation today that I have with Ralph. And I'll lead up to it later. We're going to have a couple of other things first. And so, Ralph, if you're listening... or your family, they'd be happy to have you comment afterwards. That would be good. Give us an email, aboriginalvoices@cfrc.ca. So we're going to do that sort of close to 7:30.
Okay.
Now, I'm not quite sure what we're going to do here. I think we're going to go with another DJ Shub song. Is that okay?
Oh, yeah. Sounds good. Yeah.
This is just by accident, my pulling off a couple of songs. I didn't connect this to necessarily to the land, but it says Back to the Land. It's an instrumental.
Nice.
Nathan's up first, though. You know what he's going to do?
What's going to do? Tanya Dahaskigo, then on Zewa Dahusa Dadje, Ungahuwe, and Hadiwa Nodus, in the Aboriginal Voices, Oska Dewa Nyawar Oska, Ne Jota FM, CFRC.
Thank you. many dreams from which to choose.
Yeah.
tried talking to you. It's hard to see so many people lost in a way. Waited too long, 'cause everyone I know is drifting off. I wish I knew where I was going. We are all on different planes, like it's illusion. No one appears to care anymore. I wish I knew where I was going. We are all on different planes, like this boy.
in my blood.
Christian Opera. Just like the days is light and dark in the morning rays. I guess you know, just like the snow we fall, we men we fade away. A month, a day, a week, a year, just like to say that we were here. We were here in these fading memories, so we were here. These bleeding stories, so we were here. And these disappearing words, even when they start losing me there. Pinatamasok pa matsuin, we went sa sin, maga, kaneyo at sick, we ay man.
For 50 years, the Banri Foundation has supported the continuing education of women at Queen's. Join Banri for its 50th anniversary gala on October 24th at 7 p.m. at the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts. This event marks half a century of empowering women through education. Tickets are free, but registration is required. To reserve your spot, visit the Banri Center's website, follow Banri Center on Facebook and Instagram, or email brc@queensu.ca.
Hey, I'm Julian Taylor, and I'm excited that my radio show, The Jukebox, can now be heard on CFRC 101.9 FM out of Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. The show is all-inclusive. I only play music that I love and think that you'll love, too. So tune in every Tuesday morning from 10 a.m. to noon right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
I faced it. I have Alzheimer's disease.
My diagnosis has let me get on with my life my way.
The more we learned about my grandfather's dementia, the more we could face the future and make plans.
My husband Tom and I spoke to our doctor right away.
I have Alzheimer's, but it doesn't have me.
I faced it. So can you.
For more information about early diagnosis, visit alzheimer.ca.
And you're back with Aboriginal Voices here on CFRC. And I'm going to have some fun with this because I get to share Ralph Boston's conversation with me that we did at his home yesterday, I guess it was. We were having fun going through his paper that he wrote about the Mississauga people north of the Kingston area. And he actually has maps there. And as I got going through it, I thought, oh, this is really fabulous how he's put it all together. Anyway, I'm going to go to share a little bit of information before we start, because Ralph is going to mention, and I had to stop and think about this, because he mentioned settlers, you know, who came in to have to clear some land or use land for growing their food and growing enough feed for the animals they might have, and be it an oxen, a horse, or milk cattle, chickens, you know, sheep if they had, you know, so they would have to kind of have so much territory. And he talked about how many acres the people needed. And I looked up and said, okay, well, this is the settlers coming in and would need anywhere from between, he's going to mention 20 to 100 acres. And then he's going to equate that to indigenous peoples and an indigenous family using the land. And he said that was in square miles. And I thought, okay, we got to equate these. In the area of 1 square mile, you need 640 acres. So when you're listening to Ralph talk about it, you can sit down and calculate, you know, how far would that be? And, you know, how does it equate? So we're going to go to Ralph Boston, and I really enjoyed my conversation with him this week. And let's see what he says now about this.
So this is a second interview with Ralph, and it ends in 3, 2, 1. And Ralph, you and I have been, after all that music, we've had time to talk and think about things. And you're going to go to this paper that you wrote called History of the Mississauga People.
Well, I was going to give you this number first.
Okay. And, yeah, you were mentioning earlier about how much land a nomad group
right.
might need.
Well, this is what I'm going to give you. A settler homesteader and his family, one family, requires 20 to 100 acres of land to survive. It's got to be arable land, partially cleared, deciduous woodlands for farming, and also for providing heat for the house. The indigenous group of people, extended family, require 1 to 1.5 square miles. Lakes, ponds, swampland, open land, deciduous growth, trees for harvesting as part of the life of the nomadic lifestyle.
That's a large territory.
It is.
Yeah.
But that's what you require.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of what I said in here relates to that. It's a lot of territory, but on the other hand, if you're living off it and managing it, you've got to move around it annually. I'm not reading
yes.
this.
No, keep going. Yeah.
And that means that it's dependent upon when the harvest is most viable to maintain the stocks of fish, game, the fruit and whatnot that you're eating.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did was bring their tents and whatever they were going to use for accommodation, put them up and stay there as long as a food supply was able to be cropped and not destroyed.
Right.
And then they would move on to a new location where the food supply had changed to a new stage probably. So you start with, you know, like strawberries, and you move to something else, and they move to something else, and you're going around the property. And it may be a zigzag path, because it may have fishing as well as game, as well as edible products.
And also it would be close to lakes and streams, and so they would have
include that
because
you needed the fish.
Right.
There's another thing I picked up in here. One of the things I found in my research was that the diet of the indigenous people was so different than milk-fed babies of the white man that they matured in half the time. So that they were able to be moved around much sooner, either half the time or even less than that. So that that meant that the indigenous people, with their kind of food, were actually having the women able to bear children and maintain the life cycle of the land as well as raise their own children. Whereas on a milk diet, you don't have that extra reduction in...
just the thought about that. The milk diet means you stay near the cow.
That's right.
At the farm.
It's fine
instead,
for the farmer.
So that's it.
But it's not for the nomad.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that I thought was really fascinating. And I didn't get that until the very last few days of my field work.
Okay.
But so...
So I just want to kind of go more into your work on finding out where did you find the information about the Mississauga or the Algonquins who were living in the area that you were looking at. For example, Latimer, Ontario, or even some of the other places that you mentioned.
I'll talk about the sources of my information then, shall I?
Okay.
Since there were no people to talk to, really, I had to rely on paper sources. And I found that the best sources of information about the indigenous people in the territory north of Kingston were the libraries. And the reason for that was most important things that went before town councils had to be kept somewhere. So the libraries kept all the records for municipalities. And as a result, you get some stories there where you have somebody who comes in and wants $10 to buy something necessary and has no income. What are you going to do about it? So it's got to go to council as to whether this payment, which was already made by the kindness of the clerk, was suitable, and does it set a principle? And I discovered that this was fairly common practice, that things like these minor transactions that were borderline as to whether they were acceptable or not, or any anomalous behavior of people that was brought to the attention of council, those are special items that were kept in libraries because they weren't really township or municipal business, so they weren't kept in the municipality's archives. So the libraries were the source of much of my information, and that's where I found that by sitting down and going through these documents, annual notes of the Recreation Society or something like that, anything, you would come across information. The last two items in this paper of mine, they came from two municipalities in the northern area of Kingston, whatever I'm talking about. And they found that the municipality pushed these things into their library and were embarrassing and didn't want to have them available, so they pushed them into the library. The library decided that these are really municipal records and should be kept in Kingston. So they shipped them to Kingston. Well, they didn't belong in the Kingston history, so they went to the Kingston Library.
The main library downtown.
The main
Kingston.
Library down here.
Oh, okay.
Well, I stirred up a bit of a hornet's nest because I found it, and I said, "Golly, I found this," where one of the townships decided to take the indigenous property and issued orders in council and did. No remuneration. Kicked them off their land. Mm. Well, this was an embarrassment. That's why it was being moved around. So when we found it in the Kingston Library, the Kingston librarian got a little concerned. So they said, "We'll send it over to the library at City Hall because it's a municipal matter, not one for us." And they've lost it.
Oh, no.
So this is why you can get information out of a library that's very folksy oftentimes. The residents have written up something and it's been to the library and said, "Oh, this is not worth it." They put it away. You know, about a drunken brawl is one with about the behavior of the native people after they've received their money, the annual donation from the government, rolling around in the snow and celebrating things like this. So at any rate, when you ask me sources, the libraries are first rate. Mm-hmm.
Now, some of the areas that you wrote about in the book, like Bedford Township and Bedford Mills, and, I don't know if you went as far as Chafee's Locks in the next county.
Yes, I did.
But that whole area, there are a lot of ancestors.
Yes.
For going back that connect to Algonquin and the Mississauga. Yeah.
Well, one of the other interesting things I found in this library bed was why were there no records for Seeley's Bay in the library? Nothing dealing with Indians. Geez, that's weird. And I poked around a little bit further, and I discovered what I think happened was on one side of the river, the Cataraqui River, it was Iroquois, that was on the east.
Okay.
On the west side, it was Mississauga. The darn Iroquois were always raiding the Mississauga to grab wives and kids and to bring back warriors to ceremonially just kill. And the Mississauga were a peaceful nation, always have been, back through generations. And they didn't like this because they had to go back and try and rescue or punish the Iroquois. Well, this was disrupting the fur trade because you couldn't go get your furs sold if you were at a feud with the other side at the time that you had your furs and the French were coming through as traders. So they negotiated a peace agreement between the two parties along the river. And a mile back on either side was the new border for the Iroquois and for the Mississauga. Now, they were allowed to hunt there. Well, often the Iroquois found a hunting party would pick up a wife or something, so there'd be a retaliation, but it really no longer disrupted the fur trade.
So the two groups were able to come to use the physical barrier of a river.
That's right.
And to protect on either side
to socially handle a problem.
Right.
And that meant that on one side of the river, the French would do their fur trading, and on the Belle Island side, the Mississauga would do their trading. But the only way I picked this up was the library didn't have any information about Native people in either Seeley's Bay or across the river. So that was one of the other interesting things I came across.
The you said that there were artifacts found, like arrowheads and that sort of thing, and I know the waterfalls at Bedford Mills that was actually altered a little bit to put in a chute for a mill to be built there when the British brought in their people to use that as a power source for milling. But that was sort of a transition point, because that area at the lower part of Bedford Mills waterfall there was protected from the really extreme weather.
Yes.
And so that was that whole area, and now there's a road there called Mississauga Road, Massasauga Road, I guess it is. But the name Mississauga, Massasauga, Mississauga, you know, as we get going, we're learning the language, it's all the same group, so reference to a group, but I'm finding that they're also, because of the geology of the area, so it's where the Canadian Shield and meets or gets closer to the limestone area, and the plant growth on each side of those geological formations differ.
Yes.
And at that point at Bedford Mills, that's a location where a group of people could stay, depending on the time of the year. And one time of the year they would get their birch from birch bark, and another time of the year they would get their maple syrup, or they would get their, you know.
And this was a gathering location.
That's right. Yeah. And also it was a great gathering location if you look at a map of before they built the Rideau Canal, the way the waters were.
This was what we found on the Queen's University Biological Station property, that on a lake, on the shore of it, they found a basket full of arrowheads. This was a site for trading.
Yeah.
But they never found anything else. Why? The people were nomadic, but this was a trading site. And so it was the only place that we've ever found any significant number of artifacts.
Mm. So would it have been like a trading, I'll use the word trading post, but a center where everybody could come to?
Everybody could come to.
And then they would, and some of the things would get lost or left behind?
That's right. Yeah. But this was on Mississauga property, so it was the people of the Mississauga who were gathering there preparatory to going and doing the trading with the French, for instance. Mm. I think.
Yeah, but they weren't actually making the arrowheads
there.
They were actually putting
this was
them.
A trading, a gathering spot.
I've been out there at the Queen's site a number of times, and I wish I'd known that information. I would have looked at it differently, but now I'll have to go on another trip.
Well, there's another spot that's handier, where the two have Buck Lake, where the south branch has a boat dock area.
Right. Right now there's a bridge over and a road goes
through. That's right.
Okay.
On the southwest side, there's a house way up high, a cottage. Mm-hmm. On the area below is a plateau. There have been Indian artifacts found there. So that is believed to be a trading site. Mm-hmm. But I've never found anything there, but I haven't really looked.
There's a log cabin there still.
Yeah.
And the people who owned the log cabin, before they had a bridge, the people who owned or who lived in that log cabin had horses, and they had a rope platform that worked like a pulley, and the horse would get on, and the horse would then start to move, and it would turn the treadmill, uh-huh, basically, and pull the rope across so that the stagecoach or the people wanting to go from one side to the other were pulled over. And when it was time to go back the other way, they moved the horse around, and the horse would then walk again. The story was told to me, and that's when I heard about the idea of going from both directions uphill, uh-huh, because they had to tilt the platform enough, just enough for the horse to walk to make it easier for the horse. So the horse walked uphill both ways. But I do know that there are some people who are indigenous who still live in that area.
Yes.
And they're connected
in that area.
Yeah, but they're connected to the people who ran
right
that.
There.
Yeah.
Well, along the Mississauga Road,
yes,
there are fellows that I hunted with that are half-breeds.
Mm. So they're keeping the stories alive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is fascinating, Ralph. I've taken up a lot of your time. And I'm really enjoying this. So maybe we could get together and do this again?
Well, that's, I think, because I really haven't talked about some of the things in here.
Next time we'll dig into the real details, if that's okay.
Let me tell you one of the things that I want to get back to. And since I've said, I've solved the problem for Cubs personnel. Mm-hmm. There were no people on their property. Yet it was used, and so were my properties. But then that begs the question, if they were the last of the nomadic people of the Mississauga, and they were, then where did the Mississauga come from? Hmm. And this is where I'm beginning to get into that area, which is the history. And I've started about where human population began and worked back. This is the part that's missing. Because what I've been talking to you about now is the tail end of how the Mississauga got there. They were the last surviving nomads. Mm-hmm. But all along the north shore of Lake Ontario, down in Niagara Falls area, and up along to Lake Huron, that's where the Mississauga were. Mm-hmm. And what were they doing? And they had been nomadic at one point, but they found the problems that our Mississauga have been finding more recently, and as a result, they were no longer nomads. They had settled. Mm-hmm. And then the problem is the population began to increase. And what happened was that when the War of Independence came, I'm talking about this now, the Americans in the 1750 or whatever it was pushed everybody up and tried to conquer Canada. Well, it meant that all the U.E. loyalists came across and landed on the North Shore, mm-hmm, and pushed the Mississauga north.
Right.
And that's why we're originally, there was this band along there, this pressure pushed them all to a new location. And then there was disease, and the population dropped to half, really, I think. But I've been going back along that to say, well, where did they come from? And this gets into where did humans first settle? And then taking the Mississauga, how did they get down to the North Shore on Lake Ontario? So that's what's in here yet that we should talk about.
We'll do that next. And I'm going to play a song called Respect. And this is a brand new song for Aboriginal Voices. And so, Ralph Boston, thank you very much for this. And we'll have another conversation and share with our listeners here on Aboriginal Voices.
Well, I look forward to it.
We'll be right back. You gotta give it all you got.
Against the wall, I'm holding my head up so I don't fall. No, it ain't too late, we ain't too far gone, 'cause there's more love than hate, and there's more right than wrong. So won't you sit right here beside me and rest your weary head, and let those sleeping dogs lie in someone else's bed. Taking the high road, putting the fight down, taking the high road out of town, taking my mind off, taking my mind off the fighting side, I'm walking away, walking the line. No, it ain't too late, we ain't too far gone, 'cause there's more love than hate, and there's more right than wrong. So won't you sit right here beside me and rest your weary head, and let those sleeping dogs lie in someone else's bed. Me and rest your weary head, and let those sleeping dogs lie in someone else's bed. And let those sleeping dogs lie in someone else's bed. Taking the high.
Hi, I'm Justin Evangelo, cancer survivor and visually impaired new programmer at Trent Radio, hosting a show every Friday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. called Disenabled. I have less than 1% vision in my right eye, and I love making radio every single week, getting people's voices out there who have similar physical disabilities.
Remember, no one has a disability on radio.